Hey there, Next Wheel listeners, this is Andy. Before we dive into this episode, I wanted to let you know about an exciting change. As you may have noticed, we have been including episodes of one of our other shows, Movies We Like, in this feed. Well, we are thrilled to announce that Movies We Like has grown so much that it's now ready to strike out on its own. From now on, to catch the latest episodes of Movies We Like, you'll want to head over to its dedicated feed and hit that subscribe button. We've got plenty of other great content lined up, and we don't want you to miss a thing. Don't worry, though, the Next Reel Film Podcast isn't going anywhere. We'll still be bringing you the same in-depth discussions and analysis of your favorite films right here in this feed. So if you love what we do with Movies We Like, be sure to search for it in your favorite podcast app and subscribe today. Thanks for being a part of our podcast journey, and now let's get back to the show.
Andy, can you believe we've almost hit 700 episodes of the Next Reel?
I know, it's crazy. And with all the other episodes in our family of podcasts, we are well over 1,200 episodes of movie conversation. It's really pretty amazing that we've gotten to have these in-depth movie chats every week for over a decade now.
And we couldn't have done it without our loyal community of film fans. Their support over the years has meant so much.
For sure. That reminds me, we should give the merch store a shout-out. Buying shirts from thenextreel.com/merch is a great way listeners can continue to support the show. Plus, they get to sport our great designs.
Absolutely. I think sometimes folks forget we have a variety of shirts, mugs, phone cases, and more available. In fact, a great place to start is with a shirt sporting the Next Reel's logo.
We also have that classic Fast Times Spicoli Surf School tee, or the weirdly popular Rusty's European Tour shirt.
The one from National Lampoon's European Vacation. Why is that so popular?
Search me, but we have sold a ridiculous number of those. I guess there are a lot of Rusty's taking trips to Europe?
We're always adding new designs based on movies we've covered, like our brand new design for A Streetcar Named Desire, featuring a streetcar named Desire. So if you want to rep your love of TNR and films, head to thenextreel.com/merch.
Every purchase helps us continue to have these weekly in-depth conversations. So visit thenextreel.com/merch today.
And as always, thanks for listening and being a part of the Next Reel community. We've got lots more great movie chats coming your way.
Welcome to Movies We Like, part of the True Story FM Entertainment Podcast Network. I'm Andy Nelson, and that over there is Pete Wright.
This is Pete Wright.
On today's episode, we have invited actor Patrick Fabian to talk about John Huston's The Man Who Would Be King, a movie he likes. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Hey, man. How you doing? Thanks for having me on.
We are thrilled to have you, thrilled to talk about this particular movie. John Huston's a director that we love. We've, you know, done series on John Huston. He's just a fantastic director. And this was a film that neither Pete nor I had seen before. And so we were very excited to get it on the list.
Wow. Well, you know, right? What? Guess what? That's okay. I'm an old man. So it literally is the movie that made me say, I want to be an actor. That's why I chose it.
Okay. So, well, that's why we want to talk about it. But when did you, how old were you when you first saw it? Because we're all men of a certain age, Patrick. I mean, don't artificially age yourself, all right? My beard's as white as your head.
You know what? Fair enough. This is a podcast, right? No photographs. I was probably 14 or 15 when I saw it. And my friend Scott Atkinson, who was going to high school with me, said, oh, you should see this movie. We should watch this movie. And so we did. And I had, you know, I had been in the arts and I'd been in band and I'd been in chorus and done all that stuff. And I was in high school, I guess, 14, maybe not, maybe middle school. All I know for sure is that when I saw that, I was like, wow, the scope of it, the landscape, you know, I'm a little shit kicker from central Pennsylvania. And all of a sudden, they're showing exotic lands, exotic things. There's a couple of, there's a naked butt shot of an exotic brown-skinned girl. And I was like, wow, that looks like Lentha Lucas, you know, and who was a girl in my class. And
so all that. Shout out to Lentha, if you're listening.
Yeah, God knows where she is, you know, lawsuit incoming. And,
yeah, right.
and it was, you know, I just watched it again last night. Before the podcast, because I wanted to sort of reclaim it because I hadn't seen it in a number of years. And it's problematic, obviously, in a lot of ways, in the lens of looking through things now in some respects. But I think what it retains is what it is advertised, a sense of adventure, a sense of buddy. It's Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid for Brits in some respects. You know, it's all about buddy. It's about man bonding. You know, there's a dearth of women in it. I get it. It's also English versus being a colonial empire in India. It's got lots of things that make you sort of raise your eyebrows and go, you can't act like that. Except I saw that. And when it ended with that final bit, I was like, wow. I didn't know if I wanted to be Peachy. I didn't know if I wanted to be Daniel or if I wanted to be Rudyard Kipling. I just knew I wanted to be one of those three guys because it seemed like they were having the time of their life. And it was these exotic locations. It was this world I'd never thought of. And I was like, oh, and the key to getting there is to be an actor.
All the little boys say, I wish I could grow up to be Rudyard Kipling.
Well, but that's Christopher Plummer. Those are three.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, for a 14-year-old boy in Pennsylvania, those are three fully grown, capable men. Capital
yes.
M.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And they weren't afraid to be loud and articulate. I mean, I love hearing Connery and Michael Caine yell at one another because they bite off every single word. Nothing is, you know, nothing is underplayed or under their tongue. It is all out there. And I loved that.
They're absolutely big. Well, okay. So this, before we go too far down the road of this great film, mm-hmm. let's kind of follow this thread. You talked about how this was the film you saw and you're like, oh, I want to do that. I want to be an actor. So that was kind of where you got the acting bug. What next? Like, did you start looking for theater, like, ways to perform? Like, how did you begin that journey?
I guess the best way to say it is I was band president in high school. You can fill in the blanks from there. You know what I'm saying?
It says a lot.
All we needed to say about that.
Yep. You know what I'm saying? But in my school, being in band was not a geeky thing. Well, it was a geeky thing, but it was also a cool thing because we won lots of awards. We had a lot of musicians, a lot of people.
You were in the good band.
I was in the good band. And it was really fun. And I had a great time. And I was doing that. I was doing theater. I was doing musicals as well and plays in high school. And all three of those disciplines revolve around the collective. All three of those things are all about creating a singular piece of work from a whole bunch of different parts. And it's not any surprise to me that I wanted to continue doing that sort of thing. My goal was to be a first chair pit trombonist in a Broadway pit band. That's what I wanted to do at first.
Wow. Okay.
But then I got up on stage and I kind of like not having the horn in front of my mouth. And I found that to be kind of freeing and fun. So I went to college for it. You know, I went to Penn State University to get a degree in acting with. Yes. Both my parents were like, what? They give degrees in this?
What were your parents? What were they trying to role model for you?
My mom and dad were the first people from their respective branches of family to even go to college. So they put a pretty high premium on making sure they could help provide college for us. My brother went off to get a degree in political science. And then I come along and I'm like, I want to be an actor. And, you know, I have kids now and I can't believe how cool my parents were about that. What they did was steer me towards a larger university just in case a 17-year-old boy changed his mind.
And, yeah, sure.
You know, and I have to say this, hats off to mom and dad, Fabian, who still live in Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania. Dad's 91. My mom's 86. They never said no when it came to me saying, I want to do this. They said, we don't know about this, so let's find people who do. We believe in college, so let's go to college. So I went to college and I got a degree in theater. And my dad's like, you know, now what? What do you do with that?
Yeah, this was great. We've been so supportive, right? Now, show us it was worth it.
Every year, you know, they were just like waiting for me to come home at Christmas and be like, I don't want to do this anymore. And it never happened. Poor things, you know. They saw like the worst productions in the world. They would drive up to State College after work on a Friday to watch me hold a spear in a bad production of Hamlet. You know what I'm saying? And God love them. Real salt of the earth folk. I have to say, really, really, because without them giving me permission and not getting in the way, who knows? But then I skipped off and I went to Cal State Long Beach. I got myself a master's degree in theater.
Wow, look at that.
No, but guess what? My father said the same thing. Wow.
What What I gotta ask though, what is it that makes that causes you to make that pivot to decide I want to continue my education and not just hit the bricks?
Because I had followed a redhead to New York City in the summer of 86, and I'd lived in Queens with a bunch of other actors. I'd ridden the subways, I'd waited tables, and as a matter of fact, I wasn't gonna go back for my senior year. I had a job. The season was coming up, and I'm like, what am I doing? So I called a professor at Penn State. Shout out to Michael Connolly, who's now an emeritus professor at SMU, and my dad. Because I called both of them to say, by the way, I'm not going back to finish my degree. I'm already in New York smoking cigarettes with a girl. I'm good. And my father wrote me a letter, one of the only letters he ever wrote me. And he said, I don't know about your business, but I know in life, having a college degree tells at least somebody across the table who might be hiring you that you know how to finish something. And then he just made a list of things to consider. You do what you want. Keep in mind, my father and mom are paying for college. And so I'm just cavalierly saying, screw that.
Yeah, I'm done.
And my college professor said, oh, good. You're in New York. You got a girl. You're getting ready to go. The season's coming up. That sounds great. Good for you, man. Way to hit the books. He goes, oh, but here's the thing. You're going to miss my class this year. You know what? You're going to miss this thing coming up too. Well, let me ask you this. Are you going to change that much in 9 months? Are you no longer going to be like a young ingenue, you know, young leading man? I was like, well, no, probably. He goes, oh, okay. How much is acting class? I mean, because you're still going to go to acting class, right? And I'm like, oh, that hadn't occurred to me. And he goes, we're going to have to pay for that. So how's your job? And anyways, he just soft pedaled it and said, well, good luck, man. Good luck. And hung up.
Sounds like you've got the world in your hands. Yeah.
Yeah. And so they let me sit with that for a little bit. And so I came back around and called my dad and said, I think we're going to go back. You know what he said? Okay. That's it.
Yeah.
Called my professor back, said, hey, I'll see you in September. He goes, great. Nothing ever said. But the answer to the question, I didn't go to New York because everybody else was going to New York. All my friends who I was going, who I went to school with, were all going to go to New York and be artists. And I'd already done that a little bit, not really being an artist, but there was another gentleman, Tom Forum, I'm really getting history on here, but he was a graduate student and he took me aside and he took me to a mirror and he goes, what do you see? And I was like, I see an artist, a boy, blah, 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 blah. And he was like, he goes, I see a pretty good looking young man. And I said, oh, and he goes, I'd go west if I were you. And I'm like, why? He goes, because if you're young and somewhat pretty, who knows? You might get lucky and become a movie star. And nobody in acting class talked like that. Nobody suggested that dirty word.
Nobody talked like was a prophet in the voice of Truman Capote. My God, Patrick.
Well, you know, he would love that. I will call him, let him know you said that. Yeah, so I went. So I took a graduate school ride over to Cal State Long Beach, a two-year program with no intention. Like if I didn't like school, I was out of there. Los Angeles was right there. So it really was a ticket to get out there. But as it turned out, instead of holding the spear like I did in undergraduate school, when you're a graduate student, you got the lead roles. So I basically had 2 years of repertory, did a whole bunch of plays, played the lead, and then got out with 6 years of college education to be an actor under my belt. And I went to Los Angeles and Los Angeles said, who cares?
Okay.
Good for you.
Yeah, that seems to be the general first line of Los Angeles.
Yeah. So, I mean, so that's what got me. But along the way, you know, you want to tie it back to the movie, stuff that I saw along the way, other theater pieces, other actors. I was in New York. I saw theater in New York. I saw what people could do and on a high professional level. We're still going to the movies. This is before watching movies on phones. It's a collective communal thing. You go to a big theater, you sit down and you watch the thing. And I was like, that's what I want to do. And at the time, you want to do that? You go to New York, you go to LA, or maybe Chicago or Dallas. But I wasn't interested in going to regional theater. I wanted to go, hey, Tom Forel.
Yeah,
I could be a movie star. Let's
maybe
go.
You could get lucky.
Let's go.
Well, and then you end up, you really start working pretty heavily in TV, like a lot of episodes here and there of a whole bunch of different shows. Yeah, just a whole variety of things. What was kind of your thinking process? Was it just like, I'm going to take everything that comes my way? Or were you starting to like, I want to start really pushing into this particular thing? Like how did you start finding your focus?
Well, first of all, I'm still looking for that. And when you bring this up, I immediately get anxiety because I'm like, oh, right. you can shape a career if you pay attention. But I had my head up my ass. I was running around, you know.
And that's everybody until they're like late in their career. Like, wait a minute, yeah. What have I been doing?
What have I been doing?
Yeah, you know, I was waiting. I was trying to get an agent, and I was trying to get a union card, and all that stuff. And you're running around, and it does feel like a lottery because it kind of is. And it does feel like you have to know someone to get somewhere, which it kind of is. But what those 6 years of education did for me, if nothing else, and this is why I was used to not getting the job. I was used to auditioning and not getting it. That was just, and I was told that from the very beginning, that's the muscle you have to have the most of. No, we're not hiring you. Why? It doesn't even matter.
Doesn't matter.
They're just not, You're not the answer to this particular, these people with the money in the casting, you're not the answer. So it was always a numbers game in my brain. And I had a professor at Long Beach who basically gave us sort of a 5-year plan with really low expectations. Like at the end of 5 years of doing this list of things of what actors do in LA, you should probably have gotten a paid job by that point. And that's 5 years. So in my mind, I'm like, oh, I'm going to do all these other things for at least 5 years before I start to think about it. I ended up doing a Shakespeare play in Los Angeles. I got my equity card by doing it for 2 summers in a row. Thank you, Ben Donenberg, because they made me an assistant stage manager and I got a part. And when I did that part, somebody came to see the leads in the show. And those agents of the leads stopped by afterwards. And Jean St. Calvary handed me her card and said, do you have an agent? I said, no. She goes, call me tomorrow. So I called her and she goes, you don't have a resume, you don't have anything, but I can send you out. Do you know where Fox Studios are? No, I do not. And so she gave me an audition and I drove over to Fox for the first time. I went onto a studio lot for the first time, fourth floor parking garage or above. And then I walked through the studios. I mean, the studios, I'd never seen them.
Yeah, right.
And I go audition for a thing called Doogie Howser, which was this young kid, Neil Patrick Harris's first show.
Oh, please, Patrick. Please.
And I walk in, I walk into the room and there is, and this is how it's been for the last 30 years, 20 of me, 10 are a little bit younger, 10 are a little bit older, prettier teeth, a little bit, but we're all this, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And we're sitting there and I'm like, whoa. And you can hear everything and it's busy and there's an assistant, da 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 da. And then they call my name and they go in the room. And this is the casting director. Never met her before, but I had my sides. And because of my training, I was cold. I had to memorize. I knew what I was doing. I made choices. I knew how to break down a script. And so I sit there and I was like, am I reading with you? She goes, yeah. So there's my scene partner. And then, you know, there's a producer, there's a writer, there's a director. This is old school and people were still in the room. But it didn't matter because I'm reading with her. So I read with her. They adjusted me. I know how to take a note. Okay. And I did it again. And then I went outside. They went outside to a phone booth, a full-length phone booth. And I put quarters in and called Jane St. Calvary at Writers and Artists. And I said, I think I got it. And God bless her. She goes, I bet you did. But just in case, what are you doing tomorrow? I have an audition for you at Paramount.
And of course, that was so sweet.
Bless her.
Yeah, I didn't get the job. But I tell you what, eight auditions in, I did. I did get the job.
Yeah.
And then I got another job. And then I got another job. And then I finally booked a pilot within like 2.5 months of having these people actually putting me out there. And I quit my waiting tables job. And I waited for the pilot to get picked up and make me rich.
What was the pilot?
The pilot was called Rise and Shine. Judge Reinhold, Kathy Kinney, some ringer from New York. I forget what his name was. And it was a half hour show. Falsey Brand, the guys who created Northern Exposure, had done it. And so they were riding high.
How could it fail?
How about this? Not only could it fail, and I met this guy later to tell him the story. Warren Littlefield, who ran NBC at the time. We're doing a 4-camera live sitcom pilot taping. I had a dressing room. They gave me flowers. It was amazing. And so I'm there and we're doing it. And it's kind of like doing a play, which I had done bunches of. So it was really fun. And they're laughing. Warren Littlefield puts his arm around me halfway through and he goes, oh my God, I love this show. It's going to run for years. You can go buy a house. So I quit my job the next day. What more did I need? The president of the network told me to go. You know,
that's outstanding. Wow. In so hindsight,
I did. And then, of course, like 2 weeks later, I call that wonderful woman, Jean St. Calvary, and I'm like, hey, So when can I buy my house? Basically, like, when are we going to work?
You're right.
And this is when they used to shoot like 130 pilots for 20 slots. And she just goes, oh, honey, that's not going to happen. That's not going any further. But it was a good job. Don't worry, we'll get you something else. And she hung up. And I was like, oh,
wow.
And I said to my roommate, what am I supposed to do? And he goes, I guess you're supposed to get another acting job. And it wasn't until that moment that I realized it. And this, now I'm mom and dad. It's not the destination, children. It is the journey.
There it is.
It's the journey.
There it is. Yeah.
But it is. I was like,
true.
It isn't a destination. It is the thing that goes along. And to your point, a quick perusal of my resume, I've been passed around town pretty heavily. I've done a whole lot. I know I haven't said no to much because, circumstances. I like to work. I think there's always benefit in finding. I haven't curated myself into becoming somebody. You know, when I was a young actor in my 20s, we all wanted to be like, you know, Brad Pitt or James Spader. And I remember James Spader had a quote at one point. I think Brad Pitt had just done Thelma and Louise, and he shows that body of his. James Spader was quoted as saying, oh, fucking Brad Pitt ruined it for us all. now we have to go to the gym. Now we have to drink green juice. And yeah, I used to think like, oh, I want to be James Spader. I want to be Brad Pitt. I still do. But the problem is that that role's already taken and they're still playing it really, really well. And along the way, you watch people break and go. You know, everybody who got on Friends became the Friends. Everybody who came on ER became the ER people. I read for both those shows. But so did, you know, 40 or 50 or 100, 200 other guys.
And yet, Patrick, like, this is the I don't know, it's the blessing and a curse of your career, right? I look at just what's credited on your IMDb page, and it's 162 titles.
Wow.
And the result of that is you are in that sweet spot of celebrity where I'll bet a lot of people recognize you, and they have no clue from what.
I call it the St. Louis airport thing. You're in a St. Louis airport, and you're just trying to get to your next plane or get a burger or something, and somebody goes, hey, hi. Did
you sell me something once?
Yeah, right.
And I'm like, no, we didn't. And then you're standing there, and it's sort of awkward, and then you want to relieve them, and you go, well, I'm an actor. You might know me from something. And they go, oh, what is it? And now it's on me.
Yeah, now, right. Suddenly it's your job.
I'm in the St. Louis airport and I'm trying to like do a Terminator on these people, figuring what their age is, what they might have seen. And I go, Star Trek Voyager. And then they go, nope. And now we're playing a game. Now we're playing a game where I'm going to go through my resume until I can figure out what it is for them. Because I'm so broken, I need them to know. And eventually, we get down to something like, let's see, I did a sort of basically a cameo in Two of a Kind with the Olsen twins. That's it.
Oh, wow.
No,
you were Coach Daryl. I'm like, what?
Wow. You never know. That's amazing.
But that has to have gotten easier since Saul.
Oh, I get shout outs for Howard now. That's what I get called all the time. People call me Howard in passing. And we were just walking past the National Portrait Gallery here in London. We were going to see a show the other night. And some guy walked past and he just went, Howard Hamlin? I'm like, in the flesh. Just keep walking. I knew things had shifted a little bit. I think it was about season 3 of Better Call Saul. I happened to be in New York City and I happened to be in Central Park walking. And some guy was jogging on that inner ellipse and he saw me. And he looked at me and he goes, Howard, you get off Kim's back. You understand me? And I waved him. He goes, I'm not kidding. He didn't break stride. He didn't take his headphones off. He just yelled at me like a New Yorker and kept going on.
Wow. By. Of course.
And at that point, funny. I kind of was like, ooh, I've made it.
There it is. Yeah.
Who knew that would be the moment?
And Better Call Saul, I mean, that's, you know, a fantastic show from this really creative world. But I mean, it's a much more recent thing. Looking back on your career, thinking of all the different things you have been a part of, was there a point where you performed in a show or a film or something where when you walked off of it, you were like, oh, I feel like I so completely connected with that character. I did exactly what I set out to do. You know, I was in a great groove with the director and you see the finished piece and it's like, that's it. That was perfect. Like, can you remember where that first moment was where you're like, that was it?
I don't know. It's funny. A lot of things that you think are feeling good at the moment, you look at them and you're like, oh, that's not what I thought was going on. And that could be any number of factors, by the way. That could be, oh, the script isn't what I thought it was, or the lighting, or the director. You can point the finger everywhere. But rarely do I feel like, oh, yeah. And then I look at it and I'm like, oh, yeah. Last Exorcism came off real well. That was fun. Some people saw that.
Yeah.
But, you know, for the most part, when you end up being a guest star for your career, you're plugging into other people's things all the time. So you really have to go in with the notion of, like, what am I servicing here? It's not about me. They're going to come around on my shoulder anyways for my big speech so they can see the reaction to the guy who's interrogating me or the girl who's interrogating me. Learned that fast. I was like, oh, this is my close-up. No, it's not. They're going to come on your face for a second, and then they're going to cut to the person they're paying $1 million to. That's what they're going to do.
You get to shine, not too bright.
Yeah, yeah, a bit. I'm not complaining. It's been a great and varied career. I'm a working actor. That's a rare breed in itself. You know, I had a lot of fun along the way, too, basking in people's glow. You know, working on Friends, working on Will and Grace, easily two of the funnest nights I have ever had as an actor. And I probably only had about 5 or 6 lines or setups in the whole evening. But to be a part of that energy and watch that thing work, watch that machine roll. You know, it's like seeing the Stones in their prime or your favorite band in their prime and stuff like that. Like, they were on fire and you're like, oh, I get to be standing in that right now. And that feels great. That's a rush. And then consequently, when you find yourself working on something like Saul, there are moments where probably after about 2 or 3 seasons where I finally felt like I deserved it or belonged. Imposter syndrome always there. I started to feel a little more comfortable because everything was sort of, I knew the DP, I knew the crew, I knew my fellow actors, and it really felt like I belonged. And then there'd be moments where all of a sudden it really let fly with like Ray or Bob, and there'd be that wonderful moment where you'd sort of look around at one another and be like, oh, I think that might have been good.
Yeah.
And then you see it and you're like, oh shit, they shot the crap out of this. It looks good. And you get happy about that. I've been in plenty of crap. Again, IMDb will show you. There's a lot of chuff in there. But I don't regret any of the jobs I've taken. That's for sure. They've all had their charms and their, and you know, especially when you're starting out, I always give young actors entering it, you know, this notion of like, well, I'm going to do this and I'm only going to do this. Man, it's a crooked line in life no matter what, particularly in this career and anymore. So much stuff is out there. I don't think anybody's really dinging you, but a career can be shaped and whatnot. But I always like to say yes, because yeah, you did that thing for the weekend for that short, and it was a terrible script, and the director yelled and threw chairs, and it wasn't very fun. But guess what? The writer saw that you tried to make sense of her words. And in 5 years, when she gets better, she's going to remember and be like, oh, they actually got it. And you don't know. No one said, oh, I can't wait to go make this piece of shit so it's shitty. Right?
Yeah, right.
People want it to be their best. And even when you have all the elements, it doesn't work. That's kind of the miracle of it anyways. Dude, you put on paper, we're all going to get Oscars. And then you see it, you're like, oh no, I can't even place why, but it doesn't work. And then something else just coalesces and leaps. So you don't know who those people are. Everyone's going up and down the ladder all the time. Just, you know, say yes, have fun, see what you can get out of it. And, you know, sometimes it's just a good cocktail story.
Yeah, it definitely is a business of relationships. That is for sure.
Yeah.
Do you find, as far as working in studio, live studio audience sort of environment, as opposed to working on something on location, do you find you have a preference, or do you feel like you're bringing different energy, or you need to bring different energy depending on which one it is?
Oh, totally different energies. Matter of fact, I was working on the last sitcom I got to do. I got to work with Patty Heaton on Carol's second act. And I was working with her and Cedric Yarborough and some other people who were like funny people who know about punches and rhythms. And I'd been, you know, wearing a suit and staring off in the distance with smoky blue eyes for 2 seasons. You know what I'm saying? So all of a sudden I'm doing this live action thing. And Patty was great because Patty knows. Patty Heaton hears it. She knows what the setup is. She knows where the joke is. She knows the funny. I mean, she's done 200 and some episodes of Raymond and 200 episodes of The Middle. So she knows what she's talking about. And it was funny. One time we were doing something. I was playing like her doctor/love interest. And anyways, I fumbled a line on tape night because I was nervous. I hadn't been in front of an audience in a while. It was our first go. And I blew the line, and she put her arm around me and she said to the studio audience, she goes, "You have to forgive Patrick. He's on award-winning drama on another network usually." And it bathed me in a quick moment of shame. And then absolutely, we howled with laughter, and there was no problem with that afterwards, you know. But it had been a while. I enjoy it because I love live theater. I hadn't done that in a while either. And there is an energy that you feed off of. And you can be guaranteed you're not going to be working at 3 o'clock in the desert, you know, when you're doing a sitcom.
Yeah. That is very true. Very, very true. Well, I think at this point, we should shift our conversation to talk about this fantastic movie that you brought for us to discuss, John Huston's The Man Who Would Be King.
There is no place on Earth too forbidding. There is no adventure too dangerous to dare. There is no dream of wealth and glory too impossible for the man who would be king. Connery and Kane. Rogue and renegade. Reckless and fearless soldiers of fortune on the richest adventure of their life. Across 1,000 miles of danger, come with Sean Connery and Michael Caine as they try to capture a whole country, a scheme for rascals to become royalty in the long-lost land of Alexander the Great. Rudyard Kipling's The Man Who Would Be King. They share the treasure. They share the danger. They share the adventure. Sean Connery, Michael Caine, and Christopher Plummer in John Huston's The Man Who Would Be King.
Well, I'm curious. You guys said that you had never seen it. Did you know about it? Was it in your zeitgeist at all?
Yeah, but you know, everybody has blind spots, right? I'm always surprised when we're talking to people about the movies they haven't seen that are really core to my identity. And this one, I know, was core to a lot of people, clearly to you, but it was an absolute blind spot. I didn't know what it was. I couldn't have told you who was in it. I just knew it was kind of a North African adventure movie. And that was it. I was blown away by what this movie did for me. Blown away.
I mentioned earlier, like on the Next Reel podcast, Pete and I have looked at John Huston a bunch of times. We talked about him in some film noir series we did. We did a whole series on just John Huston films. But this one was just never one that kind of ended up on the list. And I don't know if I could even say why it didn't end up on the list. It just I mean, he's got a very long career, but that's probably why. Yeah. There's a lot of movies to pick from. I've always known about this, and it's been out there. And it's a list of, you know, those adaptations from Rudyard Kipling. And, you know, I think a lot of the Rudyard Kipling stories you look at now through different eyes about, like, you know, what, you know, the British colonialism, like that whole aspect of a lot of the stories that kind of flow through his works. But I don't know. I love Sean Connery. I love Michael Caine. I love Christopher Plummer. Like, all the reasons for me to have watched this much earlier in my life are there. It's just, I hadn't. And so it was very exciting to see that you'd picked it, because I thoroughly enjoyed myself with this one.
It felt like watching it for the first time again last night in a lot of ways, because there were shots that I'd missed. I think in my memory, the movie is only once they get to the big city, once they're summoned to the big city. And then I realized a large portion of the movie is the journey, is the traveling, is the whole setup, is this laying the groundwork of the Masons, and all of that. But along the way, there's all this observational stuff, this sense of destiny, both as a country, as Englishmen, entitlement, the way they treat people. And yet there's a code of honor that is both a military code of honor, and then this idea of the Freemasonry thing that reaches back all the way to Alexander. And I love that part of it. You know, that's the part that feels like a real link to the past that actually could be true.
That's an interesting element to the film. And, you know, right after Pete finished watching it, he texted me. He's like, "We need to figure out what we need to do to become Freemasons." Like, there's like,
I mean,
there's,
you gotta clearly aspire to something.
There's clearly something to this that, you know, you're connected to history. It was a really interesting element of the story. And like you said, it could be true. Like, were Alexander the Great and the people in his time when they wandered through Kafiristan and Afghanistan, were there elements of Freemasons working through there that were actually helping build these communities that ended up being, you know, centuries later what they were in the film? Who knows? But it made for such a fascinating story when you have the head priest open up Connery's shirt to prepare to stab him, and he sees that the Freemason pendant around his neck. Like, I don't know, it was a fascinating element that spoke to a thread of history that I don't know, it just feels like when this ended, I'm like, I need to look and see, was this actually based on something that happened? Like, it puts that in your head.
It feels like it could be true. And
yeah,
and that notion of you know, the chance meeting, the chance of the watch and all that. Well, Connery has it in his speech. Daniel Dravitt has it in his speech when he gets all full of himself and says, I'm not leaving. And he starts to connect. It's so beautiful because it's such human avarice. It's such the human condition to not just leave the table when a winner. Peachy says it. Oh, come on, man. We've had a great streak of luck. Let's cut and run. And if he says yes, completely different movie. Then we see them in the south of France. They successfully do it.
Sure.
But, yeah. But you know, the tragedy, it's like watching, you know, the car wreck in slow motion. You know, he's not going to do that. And you know, he should. And then when he says stay an extra day, I'm like, no, Peachy, go.
This is the thing that I find so interesting about this movie is that it is up until that moment, kind of an adventure buddy comedy. Like you said, it's the Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. And then from that point, it takes a gentle left turn and then a hard left turn. It becomes both it is the least John Huston of Joss Huston's movies until the end when it is the most, right? Like,
right.
It is a really interesting sort of litmus test for how you feel about John Huston as a director, that we get this movie which takes that moral choice or that egoic choice of, it's crazy to me, but I think I was meant to be the king of these people. I think I was meant to be a god king. Who says that, right? And here we are, and he's going to lose his head, which is carried in a bag around the world.
Right.
Unreal.
Right. It's unreal because you're right. I'm with him, and then his ego gets better of him. But that Peachy says, you know, may you rot in hell, Daniel Dravitt. When Kane comes back, when Peachy comes back and says, "I'm all loaded up. You want to check? You want to check anything I shouldn't take?" And they have that whole scene between the scribs, and at the very end, he opens the curtain and he flashes that smile, and he's not a king, and he's not an egoist. He's his friend. And he says, you know, oh, come on, stay a day and walk me down the aisle.
Yeah, watch me get married.
And you're like, oh. And he goes, I'll do that for you. It's such a wonderful moment. And it's the last moment of, well, you're right. Then it starts to go dark. And the direction, we keep going back to the eye off kilter, right? And the woman on the ground, like, it's all this cacophony of awfulness when he's, you know, he has to have the girl. He has to have the girl. It's and when they flip, you know, she bites him, and she goes from being, as Peachy says, the Venus de Milo, and the thing that he wants. Immediately, he calls her the slut. Bit me, and I was like, oh, that's one of those jarring things where you're like, oh,
truly, yeah.
So we go from this to slut, and I'm like, well, it fits in the time, but for modern watching and modern ears, it really is sort of, you can circle that moment as indicative of like everything that's wrong with men. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, and it speaks to the what I found interesting is like there is, and I haven't read the Kipling book, but I couldn't help but feel like this was very much not necessarily a celebratory look at British colonialism. Like it really feels like Kipling was saying some pretty nasty things about how some of these Brits behave and think of themselves when they're in this place of, we'll just say, other, and they feel like, just because I'm here and I'm British, I'm better than anyone else around me, and so it's my right to rule. Like, there's kind of that element already in here, right? And then as they decide, we're going to just go be kings in Kafiristan. We're going to, you know, find these people. And like they take on that role and they succeed. And everybody like totally buys into it because they've got guns, really.
Yeah. It's a True Colors moment too, though.
It boils down to this thing. And then it just kind of keeps progressing for Daniel. And that's what was so horrifying. And Pete, it was interesting. Like, I totally hear what you're saying about John Huston, but I think that there is this real like African Queen element of like the adventure that we have at the beginning. And then it does flip into more of like a Fat City, darker, more depressing ending in the last. So it all feels very John Huston to me, but it's just, I don't know.
It's just on the fringes of those experiences though, right? Like it has a mood in the beginning because Michael Caine and Connery are funny. They're right. Legitimately funny. And I don't think much of Huston comedy, like Pritzy's Honor was, there is comedy in there. That's fine. But right, like I don't think of Sierra Madre or Chinatown or Asphalt Jungle as like just roll them in the aisles comedy. No,
no. You've got Bogey doing monkey calls in African Queen. So you've got
that's fair. You had me at monkey calls.
Now that's what we need TikTok for.
Right.
I think Kipling does. It is a comment on that. When the gentleman gets on the train, introduces himself, introduces his education, he gets in the first class car with him and shares his watermelon, offers the watermelon with him. And the contempt, the ugliness, and he gets thrown out and really nothing is said about it. I mean, they talk about it briefly, but nobody really does. They're not going to stop the train.
No.
And it's horrible. But the fact that it goes without comment, I think, is the comment. Is maybe the filmmakers put that in. Maybe that's not even sort of, you know, part of a story and stuff like that. I don't know.
You even have the Indian fellow who gets thrown off as he's doing it. He's like, thank you.
You. He's subservient. He expects it. He tried his best to give his credential. And it doesn't matter. And then when Kipling says, I noticed my watch was actually gone at the station. So he already knows that he's lying. But then he goes, well, I didn't know you were a Mason. All is forgiven.
All is forgiven.
Boys will be right. Boys. Men will be men. That's the one instance. And then, like, after, you know, the slut bit me, then they start, brass it out, Danny. Now he's back in line. They start going. And when they run down that corridor through the city before it gets filled, and you hear the guy who wanted to rule them benevolently and usher them 1,000 years of lineage, immediately says to Bellyfish, Get your shooters. We're gonna slaughter them like dogs.
And yeah. Right. Like, yeah.
Oh my
God. Right. They are your shooters. That is unreal. Yeah. That's that spirit. And I think that, you know, the bit me moment is as a True Colors moment is the moment. It's like it's the punchline on the setup that we started with on that train. Like this, if you didn't get the entitlement, if you didn't get those beats that were delivered pretty subtly, by the time you get to that moment at the wedding, it is all clear that these guys are the antagonists to these people. And
they are the other.
They are the other.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And even when he barks at him when he walks out under the bridge, you know, can't you cut any faster? It's like he still wants to order him around. And it's like, no, your fate is your fate. This is the thing that you have coming to you, deservedly so.
Yeah.
What a way out, though. I was like, don't they need that bridge? Like, now they're going to have to put a new one up. Like, that's one hell of a way to get rid of somebody.
I also thought about the crown, because I thought,
yeah,
it is Alexander's crown.
But, right.
You know, maybe they... Who knows? Maybe they thought, we'll send a goat down later and get it.
Exactly. Yeah.
The thing about that bridge, though, I think is a really interesting one, because it was the bridge that was built essentially by their leadership of the colonials, right? And so cutting the bridge is really restoring the authenticity of the people. Do they need the bridge? They didn't need it before they arrived.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, I guess it's like a bridge on the River Kwai sort of bridge.
Absolutely. Yeah. The parallels have got to be, you know, they're so good. This is busy work for a British man in order to bide time, you know. Yeah,
for sure.
Exactly.
But, you know, I was thinking about it also. Huston, it was so great. No CGI. So when he has that shop, when they go through the Khyber Pass and then he pans back and it's corner to corner, it's got to be a quarter of a mile, if not a mile, of people. And it's not just two rows. It's like six deep. And I know they're in Morocco, and I know they probably didn't get paid a whole lot, but they got paid something. So like the cities were filled with people. And there was something wonderful about realizing everything you saw on screen was tangible and fungible, you know?
Exactly. Well, even when they're, it's not necessarily a shot full of people, but just like when they're in the snowy mountain range, and again, filming in the Alps, so it's, you know, easier, but still, like you have some fantastic shots of like just two men and a mule walking in a vast, vast sea of snow. Yeah, they captured some fantastic imagery here.
And I kept, this time I was looking, I was like, oh, that clearly doesn't have to be either of the actors. That's clearly two stunt people who are like, can you back the mule up 100 yards?
Right.
It would help my framing. And they're like, can you move the camera? No, no, the camera's perfect. You need to go back 100 yards.
But, and that was an interesting moment. You talked about like destiny and everything. I can't help but feel like there's this element of the two men as they're lost, or not necessarily lost, but stuck in the mountains. There's a giant ravine that's blocking them from their way through, and they essentially are unable to continue looking at potentially dying here in the mountains. And then you have this moment where they're singing and laughing, and that causes an avalanche, which conveniently fills in the ravine so that they can cross and continue and actually make their way into Kafiristan. Like, that was such an interesting moment to depict, like, probably for them, this British idea of, you know, we are meant to do this. This was destiny for us to make it over there, you know? It was such an interesting moment.
And it also comes on the heels of them saying, that's it. The bridge behind is gone. There's nothing ahead. And they have a fairly honest assessment of themselves at that moment.
Might be the last time in the film.
Yeah. Right. I've got no good deeds to account for myself. But we've had an interesting life. Two men can't say they have seen more than we've seen. And that's enough in the age of adventure. But to your point, that and them laughing at the expense of the guy who gets the Victorian Cross and this and that, as you say, then all of a sudden it's providence. It's God literally leading them there. Oh, hey, I have to divert for just a second because
sure.
I love this film so much that I got a poster of it and I framed it, spent good money on framing it and everything else. And then I was living with somebody and somehow I got into a basement and there was flooding. And anyways, the poster then seeped in and got a watermark and possibly a bunch of mold. All I know for sure is that when I met my wife, Mandy Fabian, filmmaker and writer, the moment came in our relationship where it turned out I was going to move in with her. That's what we were going to do. So I was going to go ahead and have a yard sale and get rid of some stuff. So she comes over the day that I was going to do that, and she sees that I've got stuff in two piles, and she goes, what's this? I said, I'm like, well, this is the pile of stuff I'm going to keep, and this is the stuff I'm going to get rid of. And she looks right at the stuff I'm going to keep, and right there is the frame poster of The Man Who Would Be King. And she's like, so explain that to me. And I'm like, well, this is The Man Who Would Be King. And blah, 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 blah. She goes, no. Explain this giant stain on it and the mold, because nothing screams I'm a bachelor living alone than this. Right. And I was like, all right. Da, da, da. And so we had a discussion and da, 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 and then I'd had it for years. And it was a moment in time where I go like, oh, you know, I'm crossing a threshold. You know what? Okay. I will put this down here, but I tell you what, it's going to get, it's gonna get a lot of money. So I think I marked it like $150. This is on my front lawn in Fairfax. Yeah. So I put it there. Morning goes by, people looking at it, and people are like, oh yeah, no one's interested. I knock it down to about 75. The local Russians who are in my neighborhood are coming around and they're trying to bargain me down from 25 cents to 5 cents for a wooden spoon from my kitchen. This is the buyers I've
yeah.
got, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
The end of the day comes. It's like 3 o'clock. No one has made a serious offer on this at all. The stoners who live below me finally come out from their night before. And this guy comes out, no shoes. He's got his pajamas and no shirt. He comes out and he goes, oh, having a yard sale? And I said, yeah. And he looks over and he sees my poster with the water stain. And he goes, oh, dude, that is cool. And I just said, take it. Just take it.
Oh.
Unbeknownst to my wife, I just told her today, I ordered a brand new pristine copy of the poster, which I have back in Los Angeles in my garage, waiting for the right moment to frame.
Look at that. Fantastic.
No.
Maybe, maybe for our 20th anniversary. That seems like a good gift, don't you think?
Oh, she love it. You'll love it.
Does she share your love for this movie? Your appreciation of it?
How about this? She was unable to watch it with me last night, unfortunately. So I don't think she's ever seen it.
Oh, another set of virgin eyes for it.
Another set of virgin eyes. My niece did watch it, though. And she's in her late 20s. So we finished it. And I said, this is kind of a sausage fest. I don't know how you're going to take this. And we finished it. And I said, so what did you think? She goes, I'm trying to remember, did any of the women get to even speak? Or did they just get to take their clothes off and bite his cheek? I'll have to rewatch that. And I was like, oh.
I get it.
Okay, yeah, I understand.
The movie does not age well in that regard, a little bit.
No, but if you do take it as a timepiece of when it was made, and because it is a timepiece unto itself, it actually, to your point, man, Andy, Kipling is not really rollicking with it. He allows moments, or the screenplay allows moments, to sort of let things be, and you see it, and it feeds into the narrative, like your hubris, your English hubris, your sense of destiny over things large and small, ends up getting your head cut off. That's what it ends up getting as a false prophet, you know? So, and I don't think I'm bending it too hard to make it fit like that. I think it actually does live like that.
Right. Yeah. You know, it's interesting for what the story is. Michael Caine, his wife plays the woman in the film, and Roxanne, and she is part Indian. And that was like a big element. And I think, for him, playing this character who is, you know, definitely has that racist streak through him as far as how he behaves with these people. But when it comes to actually the production of the film, it was nice to see that, you know, he actually got on the case of the first assistant director, who was being rather racist toward the person who played Billy Fish. And so, you know, it's just nice to hear that even in the scope of the story with these characters this way, that the actor genuinely was just acting the part and didn't stand for any of that.
Oh, that's good to know. I didn't realize that. I realize I don't have any history or any go-to book to read about the making of, which I would like to do after I watched it again last night. I'm like, oh, I'd like to find out for those very reasons. Because I thought, what, is it 1974?
75, yeah.
It's 75. It's not like, There's nothing going on. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
In terms of awareness and whatnot, you know, I think Connery's like 3 years out from saying in Playboy that, yeah, he sometimes hits a woman if she needs it. Something like that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, we're just guys being guys. You know, I just saw a play about Richard Burton, who is in that ilk as well. And the plays about Burton doing Hamlet in Broadway. But what you get from it, it was that notion. Him, O'Toole, Connery, Caine. All of those guys come from a time where, well, oh, the boys are boys. Are they going to show up drunk for their professional gig? I don't know. Oh, Oliver Reed. Did you get the good Oliver or the bad Oliver? And you just sort of took it. It was sort of a thing. And so by 1975, you know, there's some fissures, but certainly that kind of coddling of do what you want was in there. So to find out that Caine is actually aware of that and trying to curb that a little bit is refreshing to hear.
Yeah, absolutely.
How about award season, Andy? A movie we liked so much, clearly it had attention.
It did have some attention. It had 9 nominations, no wins, but at least it was getting some award recognition. At the 1976 Oscars, it had 4 nominations, Best Art Direction and Set Decoration, but lost to Barry Lyndon, which I can see that. Costume Design, it also lost to Barry Lyndon. Film Editing, it was nominated, but lost to Jaws. And Best Adapted Screenplay, but lost to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. All of those I can see.
I can kind of see it.
At the BAFTAs, it was nominated for Best Cinematography, but lost to Barry Lyndon. And Best Costume Design lost to The Day of the Locust, which is, you know.
Seriously?
That old Hollywood look. It's like, you know, it's that 20s Hollywood. I can see it.
All right.
Golden Globes, it was nominated for Best Original Score, but lost to Jaws. And at the WGA, it was nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay, but lost to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Well, it's playing in a really solid sandbox for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yep.
How'd it do at the box office?
For his Kipling adaptation, Houston had a budget of $8.5 million or $50 million in today's dollars. The film premiered on the 26th of November 1975 at the Tehran Film Festival, of all places, then finally premiering in the United States December 19th, 1975, opposite The Adventures of the Wilderness Family and Sam Peckinpah's The Killer's Elite. It did well enough for itself, earning $11 million at the box office, or almost $65 million in today's dollars, which lands the film with an adjusted profit per finished minute of $114,000. This was a project John Huston wanted to make for a long time. He read this when he was a kid. It had been kind of his pet project. Sometimes pet projects, when filmmakers finally get to make them, don't work out very well, like Toys from Barry Levinson, or I wasn't a huge fan of Gangs in New York. But this was something that he had actually started working on in the 50s. He had originally been wanting to work with Clark Gable and Humphrey Bogart in the roles of the characters. He couldn't get it off the ground. Both of those actors ended up dying. Next on the list was Burt Lancaster and Kirk Douglas.
Wow. Who
he was talking to. And then Richard Burton and Peter O'Toole. All very interesting choices there. The 70s rolled around, and then he was after Robert. Speaking of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, he was looking at Robert Redford and Paul Newman. And it was actually Paul Newman who told John Huston that he's like, you really should probably be casting British actors for this. It would make a lot more sense. And that's when he went to Connery and Kane, which was like, yeah, of course, they're perfect. Like, that's, it's a great pair. And yeah, it makes sense to have Brits in the roles.
Oh my God, that's so funny. Well, at the time, he's like, I don't know, I need box office. I need, you know, whatever they're thinking, right?
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah,
and you just can't see around that next corner.
Oh, my God.
It is a story about colonialism. I think that's just fascinating. And they are, I mean, they are every bit the equal buddies of you know, Redford and Newman in this particular movie. When they're being chewed out, they do their march step out of the office. Like, those kinds of bits that are so central to her royal service, you know, I think just make the movie shine, that they just feel like they embody the role.
And am I right? Maybe you know this. For some reason, you just mentioned that. And I want to say that was a bit that Connery and Kane came up with. That was their idea to sort of ridiculously march in and do that thing in lockstep. That was, they brought that to the table.
I would certainly believe it.
I hope that's the case, because that would be awesome that they would have done that.
I guess there's no Man Who Would Be King too, though. That's the only thing the studio's like, I don't see. I mean, John, we like it, but how do I, what's...
You know, maybe Plummer goes to America and finds Butch and Sundance.
Oh my God.
Maybe that's it, because Plummer did all right.
Yeah, he did okay.
Oh my God. I remember that last shot, though, when he unveils the head.
Oh.
It walks away and you see the back. And of course, you want to see. And when it turns around, it's somehow not as grotesque as what you were fearing. In the end, it really is just, oh, the crown is pristine and the human is just
insignificant, irrelevant. Right.
The crown will continue for another 1,200 years.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so it's also why it's called Sean Connery, Who Would Be King, right? I mean, the man is like this unidentifiable generic under the crown. I think that's the message. That's a great point. What a terrific movie. I'm so glad we came to this. Thank you so much for recommending it.
Oh, good. I'm glad I was able to usher it into you for the first time. That's good.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about returning to John Huston to do more of his films. But yeah, inevitably, I would like to think we would have gotten to this one. But having a chance to talk about it now is just perfect. So thank you so much.
Absolutely, man.
Patrick, where do you have a place online where you live? Do you have any socials or place that you want people to check out or visit?
Yes, on Instagram and on Threads, I'm Mr. Patrick Fabian. And on the Twitter, I am Patrick Fabian.
Not nearly so formal.
Was there already a Mr.?
You know what? I forget the confusion at the time. I was just happy to get, at the time, this is years ago, I got a blue check and I thought I was somebody, you know? And now, of course, that's all gone. And that's okay. I find Instagram and Threads to be, well, Instagram is really fun. I like that a lot because you can just use more pictures than anything else. And it seems that more traffic is there. Although you're talking to a guy over 50, so I don't know where the traffic is anymore. And you know what I'm saying? And guess what? The traffic's not looking for me that much. So it's okay. Right. That's all right, too.
Right. Fantastic. Well, we'll put those in the show notes. Patrick, thank you again so much for joining us here today. Fantastic conversation about your career and a brilliant movie.
Thank you, Jens. Thanks for having me.
For everybody else out there, we hope that you like the show, and we certainly hope that you like the movie like we do here on Movies We Like. Movies We Like is a part of the True Story FM Entertainment Podcast Network and the Next Reel family of film podcasts. The music is Chomp Clap by Out of Flux. Find the show at truestory.fm and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Threads, and Letterboxd at The Next Reel. Learn about becoming a member at thenextreel.com/membership. And if your podcast app allows ratings and reviews, we always appreciate it if you drop one in there for us. See you next time. I love having these wonderful chats on Movies We Like with all these industry guests talking about some of their favorite movies.
So many great conversations on that show about so many great movies.
We have so much fun having these conversations, but producing the show week after week does require a lot of work behind the scenes. If you'd like to help support our efforts, one easy way is by using our originals page when shopping for books and movies that we've covered.
Your purchases made through our links give us a small commission at no extra cost to you and allow us to keep having these incredible conversations.
The originals page at thenextreel.com/originals links to the source material for all the adapted film discussions on The Next Reel's family of podcasts. Purchasing through our links supports the show.
It's your one-stop shop for Amazon and Apple links where you can buy your copy of the original source material.
Original material for Movies We Like, movies like Casino Royale,
The Silent Partner,
Never Let Me Go,
Silver Linings Playbook,
There Will Be Blood, based on Upton Sinclair's Oil.
I believe it's Oil!
Oh, yeah. I forgot the exclamation point.
Plus, by using those links to buy your next read, Apple and Amazon show us a little bit of love, which allows you to support our family of shows with minimal effort.
TheNextReel.com/originals. It's a great way to support the show and find your next page turner.
That's right. Head over to TheNextReel.com/originals to pick out your next read and dig in today. I've been podcasting since 2006. In that time, I've tried countless hosting platforms. But in August 2022, we switched to Transistor to power all of our shows here at True Story FM, and it's been a game changer.
I love the Transistor allows unlimited podcasts and storage without extra charges. We can publish so much content, and we do. If you want to start up a podcast, do yourself a favor and host your show on Transistor.
With their one-click publishing, you can get your new show onto all the major podcast directories effortlessly.
And their website builder lets you quickly build custom sites for each show.
The detailed analytics are invaluable, too. You can access all kinds of listener data anytime.
Oh, and the versatile players allow you to embed episodes anywhere to reach new listeners. Plus, the team behind Transistor is super responsive and keeps making the platform even better.
After using countless hosting services over 15-plus years, Transistor has been, hands down, the best podcast partner for us.
If you want a hosting platform to take all the worry out of getting your podcast out into the world, go to thenextreel.com/transistor and check it out.
Support our show and support your own show by going to thenextreel.com/transistor. Start growing your podcast today.